When it finally became clear to me that I often didn't understand what people were telling me, I was on the road to somewhere good. Some of the things they were trying to communicate were complicated, but that didn't seem like a good reason why I didn't understand them. If they could understand these things, why couldn't I? An accountant would tell me about the tax code in a way that made no sense. A salesman would explain an insurance policy that didn't seem to have a basis in reality. It wasn't any consolation when I came to realize that pretty much everybody misunderstands everybody else. Maybe not all the time and not totally, but just enough to seriously mess things up. People are dying because we can't communicate in ways that allow us to understand one another. That sounds like an exaggeration, but I don't think it is. When patients can't relate to their doctors and don't follow their orders, when engineers can't convince a town that the dam could break, when a parent can't win the trust of a child enough to warn her off a lethal drug, they can all be headed for a serious ending. This book is about what we can do about that, about how I learned what I believe is the essential key to good communication and to relating to one another in a more powerful way. Surprisingly, I found that key in my training and experience as an actor, and it's helped me teach others how to communicate better, especially about things that are difficult to talk about or hard to grasp. It all began with my tooth. The dentist had the sharp end of the blade inches from my face. It was only then that he chose to tell me what he was seconds away from doing to my mouth. "There will be some tethering," he said. I froze. Tethering? My mind was racing. What does he mean? How could the word tethering apply to my mouth? He seemed impatient, and I didn't want to annoy him, but he was, after all, about to put a scalpel in my mouth. I asked him what he meant by tethering. He looked surprised, as if I should know the meaning of a simple word. He began barking at me. "Tethering! Tethering!" he said. I was well over the age of 50 and certainly old enough to ask him to put the knife down and answer a few questions. But there he was in his priestly surgeon's gown and getting increasingly impatient. "Okay," I said, a little too accommodatingly. Then he put the scalpel into my mouth and cut. I didn't realize it at the time, but this was a watershed moment for me. For the rest of my life, I would be living with the results of these few seconds of poor communication, in ways that were both good and bad. First, the bad. A few weeks later, I was acting in a movie. The camera was in close on me as I smiled, a relaxed, happy smile. After the take, the director of photography came over looking puzzled, and he said, "Why were you sneering? I thought you were supposed to smile." "I was smiling," I said. "No, sneering," he said. I looked in a mirror and smiled. I was sneering. My upper lip drooped lazily over my teeth, and no matter how I tried, I couldn't form an actual smile. The problem was my frenum. I no longer had one. In case you're not familiar with your frenum, it's just above your front teeth between the gum and the inside of the upper lip. If you put your tongue at the top of your gums above your front teeth, you'll feel a slim bit of connective tissue. Or at least you will if a barking dentist hasn't been in your mouth. The tissue is called the maxillary labial frenum, and he had severed mine. The procedure was one he had invented. It enabled him to pull a flap of gum tissue down over the socket of the front tooth he had extracted. The idea was to give the socket a fresh blood supply while it healed. He was proud of his invention, and it seemed perfectly suitable for the gum's blood supply, but not so good for using my face in movies. Without my frenum, my upper lip just hung there like a scalloped drape in the window of an old hotel. After the movie shoot, I called them and explained with saintly patience that I made a living with my face, and sometimes I needed one that could smile. His response was curt. "I told you there were two steps to the procedure. I haven't done the second step yet." I was a little reluctant to let him do the second step. Maybe this time he'd have a go at the frenum under my tongue. I didn't have many Freena left, and he seemed to have an unnatural attraction to them. A couple of weeks later, I got a letter from him that was formal and cold. No hint that he was anything like sorry that I was feeling a little mutilated. It was clear that the point of the letter was to lay out his defense and discourage a possible lawsuit. Until I saw the tone of his letter, I hadn't even thought of suing, and I never did. But if he wanted to avoid a suit, he was going about it in exactly the wrong way. The experience wasn't all bad, though. For one thing, I learned to work around my freedomless smile, and my new, slightly off-kilter grin enabled me to play a whole new set of villains. Even better, that moment in the dentist chair was useful in ways I wouldn't understand at the time. I've come to see my exchange with the dentist that day as something that happens frequently in life. A brief encounter that threatens a relationship's delicate tissue, the tender freedom of friendship. I wasn't looking for friendship that day, but at least I wanted the feeling that I was actually being seen by him. Even though his gaze was intense, I realized that as far as he was concerned, I wasn't really there, not as a person. If I was there at all, I was something on his checklist. He was speaking into the vague mist of interpersonal nothingness. Those few minutes I spent in his chair have become a symbol for me of really, really poor communication and of what causes it, disengagement from the person we hope will understand us. That disengagement can stand in the way of all kinds of happiness and success, from the world of business to the business of love.